You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Liz Buskar is an ethicist and professor of religion at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. She's joining us today for a talk about looking at what faith can bring and what religion can bring when you are on the margins of organized faith. She has a fantastic book, which I'm sure she'll want to speak about, that is available in the G store, and I'll remind you about that at the end. But without further ado, it gives me great pleasure, and I'd ask you to put your hands together to welcome to the stage Liz Buskar. Liz.
Thanks for having me. I'm just going to jump in so we have lots of time for conversation. So there's a song that makes me cry every time. Not just sometimes, not when I'm already sad, but every single time. And the song is Carolina on My Mind by James Taylor. Now, I was born in the state of North Carolina, as was my daughter. So it could be because this song is a song about home, right? A song about two generations of where my family started. But that's not why this song makes me cry. The real reason it makes me cry is because it makes me remember my dad. So my father died 3 years ago of pancreatic cancer while I was writing this book that we're going to talk about. He died 3 years ago last month. And after he died, my sister made a playlist of songs to remember him. And I played that mix constantly for weeks. And I love it all. Carolina on my Mind is the one that's guaranteed to make me cry every single time. And this is the part that matters. It's not about the lyrics. I'm not listening to the words and thinking of my dad. What happens is closer to a physical response. So first I feel a tingling in my nose, and then a heaviness in my chest, then my eyes water, and then I have a big, ugly cry. And when that song comes on, basically my body remembers my dad, right? So now, basically, when I want to grieve on purpose, I know exactly what to do. I put on that song. And listening to that song is a spiritual practice for me. But it could also be a religious practice. Okay, so here's why that matters for today. I'm a professor of religion, like you heard. And I've spent 25 years studying religious traditions. But I have no religious affiliation. None. But I've learned that religion shapes the world I live in, but also, and maybe kind of surprisingly, the way I respond to that world. So I've been increasingly wanting to be more open to the idea that religious communities and traditions and ideas have something to offer me and others like me about what real well-being entails, real human flourishing, what it looks like. And that includes understanding why Carolina on My Mind makes me cry and why that crying is a good thing. So let me show you what I mean by another example. A few weeks ago, I did a talk at a bookstore near my home in Boston, and a friend of mine, Pamela, was there. Now, Pamela works in geriatric care, and she was in the audience, like I said, and she asked an interesting question. She said, "Look, Liz, I know the research. I know people who are religious, people who pray, people who believe in a higher power. Those people are healthier. They tend to live longer." And then she said, "But what does that mean for me, someone like me? I'm not religious, and I don't believe any of that." In other words, if religion is helpful to real well-being, where does that leave those of us without a religious identity who are deconstructing one from our past, right? And here's my suggestion. We might have been thinking about religion too narrowly. Pamela wasn't really asking whether she should believe in something. She was asking whether any of it was available to her. And I think the answer is yes, and I think it might be more available or already available than more than she thinks. Because the research Pamela was citing isn't only measuring belief. It's measuring people who have a reliable practice of feeling something bigger than themselves on purpose, and usually alongside other people. And I happen to know Pamela's family, and they care enormously about music. They sing, they all play instruments, they host an annual chamber music evening at their home. They've organized their lives around something I'd call sacred music. So Pamela already has a practice of spiritual listening. she may already be doing her own version of the thing that the research is tracking. And one of the things I did in research for my new book was 6 sound baths in 36 hours, which is not recommended. And mostly what I realized is I am a terrible listener. I was completely overwhelmed and overstimulated by the experience. So then I spent months trying to understand and try to learn how religious communities train believers to be deep listeners. And as part of that research, I spent time with Sikh scripture and did some training around Sikh music, Sikh kirtan. And that scripture I spent my time with, which is the Guru Granth Sahib, is not really just scripture, it's a songbook. It's organized around dozens of distinct musical moods, and it can also be seen as a textbook on how to become a good listener. And not all those moods in that text are good or things you might want choose to have. Yes, there's some about comfort and security for sure, but there's others about the sorrow and of separation, and another that's closer to the feeling of panic and regret. The Sikh tradition doesn't treat those as obstacles of well-being, though. It treats them as part of what well-being requires, what a full human life actually contains. And this helped me understand why listening to Caroline on my mind is not just a spiritual practice to me, but it's a religious one. So hold on to that, because I'm going to come back to it. Now, I've told you these stories right off the bat because they're instances of something much larger that's happened to me over the last 5 years as I went into religious communities to understand wellness. I wanted to know where popular practices came from and what got left behind. What I did not expect was that the religious traditions would come back at me and change what I think well-being is. Because there's wellness, and I can measure that. It's my resting heartbeat, my lean muscle mass, my BMI. I even wear something on my wrist that can tell me all those things, right? But that's not real well-being. That's not human flourishing. And I've been treating them as the same thing. The gap between them is what my new book is about, the book called Beyond Wellness. And it was religious people, Muslims fasting, recovering alcoholics, Sikh musicians, a family running a psychedelic community in a yurt in Oregon, who made that gap visible to me. Not by converting me, but by asking better questions than the ones I've been asking. So here's what I want to offer today. Not a conclusion, an invitation to do the same thing I did, to engage seriously with religious ideas and traditions and communities that aren't our own, and see what it does to your account of a good life. And it doesn't matter if you're deconstructing religion or a skeptic or spiritually curious. I'm arguing that the engagement itself is worth something, whether you end up believing at the end or believing nothing. So before I go any further, I should tell you something I didn't expect about this book. I thought I was writing for one audience. I thought I was writing for my students and my secular friends. I basically thought I was writing for folks who call themselves spiritual but not religious, right? People who are drawn to spiritual things but who feel itchy about religion, or people who never had a religious identity at all. But when the book came out, I found a second audience I hadn't planned for, people deconstructing, people coming out of church or one foot in church, sometimes out of a high-control church. And what genuinely surprised me is how much these two groups have in common, including almost word for word which parts of religion they want and which parts they don't. Because there's a list. I've heard it from 21-year-olds who've never been inside a church. I've heard it from people who have been inside a tradition for 30 years of their entire life almost. And it's the same list. And here it is. I don't want the rules. I don't want the hierarchy. I don't want obligations, and I would like to curate my spiritual practice myself, thank you very much. And that used to be my list too. But I spent decades going into religious communities as an outsider, as a nosy, note-taking, slightly uncomfortable outsider, but an outsider. And I've come out the other side thinking that list has it almost exactly backwards. That some of what we've resisted about religion is some of its special sauce. It's what makes it meaning-making, community-building, life-transforming. So what I want to do with my time today is go through those four objections. Seriously, take them seriously, one at a time, and ask what religion could look like if we reimagined it for people like us, people who left, or people who are never there, or people with one foot in, one foot out. So four objections, I probably got about 25 minutes left, so let's go. Okay, let's start with the objection that religion comes with too many rules, and consider why those rules might be valuable. And for this, I have a wild story to share. So in September 2024, I spent 3 days in a yurt in Oregon with 40 other people, dressed in white, singing hymns in Portuguese, while a number of them channeled spirits, all as part of a ceremony of the Santo Daime Church. And it was the hardest research I've ever done, and the fact that I was on ayahuasca the whole time was the least of it. So I've never, just something you know about me, I've never taken a psychedelic in my life before this, and I never really wanted to. But you can't write a book about popular wellness practices and skip psychedelics right now. Microdosing to take the edge off, very popular. Ayahuasca retreats for self-transformation, popular. Clinical trials are starting to find real effects of psilocybin on addiction and anxiety and PTSD. So psychedelics are increasingly becoming part of our wellness protocols. And since my book is full of stories of me doing different things, trying on different things in religious containers, I knew I was going to have to do a psychedelic religious container as well. So then the question was where? Now, I didn't want to go to a retreat center because those places are mostly for profit and their operations, sometimes supposedly selling an ancient ceremony, but often to tourists and often led by a shaman of some, or someone calling themselves a shaman, which is different. And traditional healers tend to accuse these retreat centers of being exploitative. They're also full of scandals, right? There are con artists that run them sometimes. There have been cases of sexual assault and abuse and even death. So it just made me like uncomfortable on many levels. And my hunch was, the whole thesis of my book was, that a religious community might do psychedelics better, right? Might make them more effective, more purposeful, and more less risky. Now, I have a close friend now named Don Latin, who's actually an expert in religion and psychedelics. He's got a great book called Gone on Psychedelics you should check out. And he suggested I look at the Santo Daime community. So Santo Daime is a religion that originates in Brazil. It's a hybrid of Catholicism and Afro-spiritualism and indigenous ceremony, all kind of mashed up together. It started about 100 years ago. There's lots of Jesus talk. They've got a Lord's Prayer. There are hymns and crosses. But instead of a wafer and wine, the sacrament is the ayahuasca tea that they call daime. And the practitioners believe that it becomes ensouled when it's gone through the process of cooking. So ayahuasca is part of, is a sacrament. So for them, it's not a drug. It's not even medicine. It's a way to bring the divine within you and communicate with the divine. So I emailed the co-founder of a Santo Daime community in Oregon. Also, the Santo Daime community happens to be legal in the U.S., and they're legally allowed to use ayahuasca in religious ceremonies, so that was a box ticked for me, too, because I'm a rule follower. So I emailed a co-founder of a community in Oregon named Jonathan Goldman to ask if I could just come and watch. I hadn't planned on doing anything. I just wanted to watch, take some notes on my liturgy. And he said, I think you should come and join us this month, drink the daime with us. It's the only way you're going to get the answers that you want. So 10 days after that conversation, I was sitting in a yurt with ayahuasca in my system. And just so you know, the ceremony I was in was 3 days. Ayahuasca is offered 3 times a day, and we don't eat during the day at all. So it's quite a physically intense experience. And the yurt got intense, too, after we took that first serving of ayahuasca. People were rocking and moaning. The woman next to me believed she was purging something evil from inside of her. Someone was spinning in the center of a yurt like a dervish. A man was doing karate kicks over in the corner. And I'll be honest, if you're on ayahuasca and the person next to you thinks that they're channeling a spirit, you also think it seems very plausible that you are in that altered state. And the whole time, Jonathan's family, the leader of this community and his family, were working. I only understood this really by the second day when I was lying on my mat with my eyes shut and I started to overhear what they were talking about. Like, his daughter had been standing up to physically block one woman from reaching the altar. She blocked the man who started pointing finger guns around the room. Jonathan had taken one participant aside and told her that almost none of what she was experiencing was real, and that her jumping up every 10 minutes and doing something loud was more about her need to be important than her really doing any of the real religious spiritual work. Now, Jonathan, leader of this community, describes mediumship as inspiration, or a mix rather, of inspiration, ego, and drama. And his family's job in that tent as the religious leaders is discerning which one is bubbling up at any given moment and shutting down the ones that are truly just performative. And he told me something that really made the power of the religious nature of that ceremony clear to me. He helped write the state of Oregon's protocols for licensed psilocybin facilitation, so if it's used in a clinical setting, because it happens to be legal in Oregon, the state of Oregon. Now, under those protocols, he said, one of the episodes that I had watched that day in the yurt, which he described as an exorcism, would have required the facilitators call the police immediately and probably had the person put on psychiatric hold. But in the yurt, it just took some hand-holding and some firm words, and it was over. Now, I'm not trying to tell you that religious people are better at psychedelics than clinicians. What I'm telling you is that the religious container held, and it held because it had content. There was a liturgy. There was a hierarchy. There was a century of explanations about what happens to a human being when they start to unravel after taking a psychedelic. And there was someone ready to stand up and look a person in the eye and say, no, that was mostly not real. Those are the rules. They're what we've called the icky part. And that's the bit we all say we'd like to leave behind. But those rules aren't only baggage. Sometimes they're the safety equipment. And here's the reimagining I want to offer, which came out of that yurt and has stuck with me since. If a practice is real medicine, if it's actually powerful and it actually does something to you, then it can have side effects. That's not a reason to avoid it. It's a reason to know what you're getting into. Rules aren't there because somebody wants to boss you around. They're there because somebody at some point watched this go wrong. And I think we might be the first generation to attempt these practices without the warning labels removed and call it freedom. And that worries me. Okay, that's one. Two, something a little lighter. Let's look at the second objection to religion, which is I don't want the hierarchy. The first was I don't want the rules. This story starts with the first time I took my soul cycle class. I booked an instructor with a reputation of being the hardest soul cycle instructor in Boston. If you don't know what soul cycle is, it's a boutique fitness cycling class with lots of music and lots of soulfulness. Anyway, so I'll call this instructor I booked with Kelly. And I want you to know, I went into this experience very optimistic. I've been doing fitness classes since middle school. I love them. I did Jane Fonda on a VHS back when we had VHSs. I took step classes. I live streamed HIIT classes during the pandemic. Out of everything I tried in this book, and I tried out 7 different practices, this was the technique I most wanted to work. And when I walked into the room, my friends, it was church. The lights were down. There was a fancy grapefruit candle burning. Bikes were arranged like pews facing a raised platform that I'm just going to go ahead and call an altar. On the wall, something called the Sanctuary Manifesto was written, promising that whoever you are, however you feel, whatever you look like, you belong here. All souls welcome. Consecrated not by holy water, but by soulful sweat. Now Kelly came in, greeted the regulars who were all in the front row, and then the lights dropped and the music came up. And for 45 minutes, we chased a beat. We climbed imaginary hills and we were told that they were metaphors for our struggles and that we built physical strength so we were building also spiritual resilience. We were told to open our chakras, but not told what that meant, to manifest, to live our most authentic lives, hooting, hollering, eyes shut, a revival meeting with better lighting. At the emotional peak during the last long climb, Kelly told us to listen to the lyrics, which were about giving up your seat on an airplane. And she said, all 25 years of her and her wisdom said, think of who you love enough that if there's one seat left on that airplane, you would give it up to them. And that was her big sacrifice she wanted to offer us. there was, this was the crisis, right, at the center of her sermon that she was going to resolve, giving up your seat on a flight home from your holiday. Now, this room has hierarchy. It has a raised platform and a charismatic figure with a microphone and a following. What it doesn't have is any accountability structure whatsoever, or any way for Kelly to know a single thing about me. Now, compare that to the other place I sweat. I lift 3 times a week at a small gym in Boston with a group of other midlifers. So there's Uncle Phil, who's like 6'6 and 60 years old, and Beth, who's 62 and has had 2 knee replacements and is my gym bestie. And if we're not lifting together, we're still hollering at each other, encouraging words across the floor. And we're all led by our trainer, whose name is G. Now, about a year ago, I set a goal. 1 unassisted pull-up this year in my 52 years old. I'm going to do an assisted pull-up, I said. And I'm not a small person. I'm what they used to call big-boned. So this actually seemed like an impossible thing to achieve, about as impossible or realistic as me running a marathon, which is never going to happen. And you don't get pull-ups by doing a pull-up. Get there by doing the unglamorous work that doesn't look like a pull-up at all, right? So just hanging from the bar to work on your grip strength, something called a scapula pull-up, which is barely any movement at all, hollow holds, or the one I hate where you like jump up and then lower yourself down as slowly as possible, fighting gravity. And then you get to use rubber bands for an assisted pull-up. And they're different sizes, but they basically help push you up, right? And I got stuck there. A rubber band, a few reps, nothing further, for weeks. And I was like, I just made my peace with it. I was like, it's fine. I'm in my rubber band era, I said. It's all good. And then one morning, I came in to do a makeup class. So I did an entire lifting program. And after that, my trainer, G, across the gym, who was training Beth, called out and said, Liz, you see that pull-up bar? Go over and try one. And I said, G, you're crazy. There's no way. I can't do one. And I'm exhausted. And he said, I think you can do it. Just go try. And so I walked over and I pulled myself up for the first time. And then I cried. And then Beth and G cried. And we were just like a huge, you know, mess. Like for the gym was a mess for minutes. And the reason I'm telling you all this is it's not about the pull-up. It's that I didn't decide to walk to that bar. Someone with more experience than me looked at me at the end of a hard morning, saw something that I couldn't see from inside my own doubt, maybe, or exhaustion, and named it out loud, told me what to do. And I trusted his read over my own. Now, the Celts have a word for that person, a namkara, soul friend, someone whose job isn't to hand you information, but to witness what you're ready for and say it before you can see it yourself. Now, my trainer G is not a Celtic monk, not that I know of, but that morning, that was his job. So here's the reimagining. The problem with hierarchy was never that someone knows more than you. The problem is authority that performs at you instead of paying attention to you, a hierarchy without any way to hold it accountable to. But the alternative to bad authority is not no authority. It's not trust your gut. It's authority that knows your name and pushes you to grow. Okay, on to the third objection, which is, I don't want any obligations. And this story is another one about my dad. Okay, so my dad was a chemical engineer. He was sharp and funny and often the smartest guy in the room, and he knew it. He was also an alcoholic. And one of my earliest memories is sneaking a sip of his screwdriver when I was 3, and I still dislike the taste of orange juice to this day. When he was 70, we had a family intervention because my stepmother told us he'd been passing out during the day and hiding bottles from her, which is something we didn't know happened. And that intervention ended with him driving himself to a Betty Ford clinic for a 30-day inpatient program. And that's where he first tried Alcoholics Anonymous. And that program never worked for him. And he said it was because it was just too religious for him. And he's not wrong that Alcoholics Anonymous is religious, because despite it being an organization credited with popularizing the phrase spiritual but not religious, it definitely has religious roots. AAM came directly out of the Oxford Group, a Protestant fellowship founded by a Lutheran minister in the 1920s, and that was designed to let you follow Jesus without institutional Christianity. So no membership, no clergy, no church, an unchurched Christian fellowship. Bill Wilson got sober there at the Oxford Group, and then when he left to found AA, he took their 6 steps for avoiding sin and expanded them to 12 steps to recover from addiction. Meetings of AA are closed with a serenity prayer. The recovery stories shape the arc of a Protestant conversion narrative. There's a whole lot of religious content once you start looking for it. But I think for my dad, the deal breaker was all the AA God talk, all their talk about higher power. He didn't have a higher power, he didn't want a higher power, and he didn't think it was important to his recovery. So what does AA have to offer someone like that? Or what does the religious content or the theological content of AA have to offer someone like my dad? And here's where I think things get really interesting. I think the idea of higher power in AA is much less a claim about theism and much more a claim about you. What AA asks you to admit is that you are not in control, not infinite, not absolute, that you are not God. That's the doctrine. And like my dad, I don't have a belief in a higher power. I don't have my metaphysics figured out, but I can believe that I'm not the higher power, and that's really powerful. I mean, I'm not going to say it's easy for me, because my toxic trait is that I think I can solve everything. I mean, you should have seen me in COVID. I was wiping off every grocery that came in the house with bleach. I was sewing masks for all my neighbors. I was going to, like, solve COVID for the street, right? And then one day I noticed that I was paying someone else to do my grocery shopping for me. So I wasn't solving the pandemic. I was just outsourcing my exposure. And of course, my whole family got COVID at the end anyway, right? So that's God, that was God play based on the wrong assumption about who I am and what I control. Which brings me to obligations. In January 2024, I attended my first Al-Anon meeting, which is the group for families of alcoholics. And the afternoon before I went, I called an old friend of my parents, who I'm going to call Vicky, just because she had gone to Al-Anon for years, she knew my father well, and I wanted her to, like, give me sort of the lowdown on the group so I could just be efficient as a researcher when I went there. And the first thing Vicky said was, "Oh, Liz, I'm so glad you're going. You're definitely a candidate for this group. Addiction has affected your life, whether you know it or not." And I explained, "No, I'm going for research, not for me personally." But she wasn't having it. So she said, "What if, instead of showing up like a researcher, you just try to listen? I think you'll find that you belong more than you know." So that's what I tried. Now, the meeting was 9 of us in a church choir room, chairs in like a horseshoe. We read AA's 12 steps off a poster, and I was uncomfortable in every way. Uncomfortable about being in a church, uncomfortable reading out loud from a quasi-religious text, uncomfortable holding hands during the serenity prayer. And I'm ashamed to tell you that as people share their experiences about their loved ones who struggle with addiction, the sentence running through my head was, "I'm not like these people," which is something my father said to me about other addicts. 2 weeks into rehab, he described the other residents to me as a bunch of screw-ups who were younger, worse, they had worse addictions, they couldn't hold down jobs. Well, he'd been a corporate executive, he'd been a closet alcoholic, he hadn't had a parking ticket in years. He told me he wasn't as bad as an alcoholic as they were. He said, "I'm not like these people." So here's the reimagining. The 12th step of AA is that having had a spiritual awakening, you go and you carry the message to other alcoholics. That obligation is part of the process. That obligation is the medicine. Everyone's talking about the loneliness epidemic that we're in now, and everyone's looking for belonging, right? We want belonging. But I think we started to think of community as a place that gives us things. Real community is not just who shows up for you, it's who you show up for. It's the Saturday afternoon thing you don't want to do, but you do it anyway. That's the part almost every wellness community drops. And I'd suggest it's religious communities, whatever else they got wrong, they got this right. Okay, which leaves the last objection to religion, which is our preference to curate spirituality ourselves. And if I'm honest, this has been my practice too. I mean, I'm practically a professional. I am a professional, right? I've spent an entire career going into other people's traditions and communities, taking careful notes, and deciding what's portable for me and what's not. If anyone's earned the right to assemble a personal practice of what's the, you know, a spirituality, surely it's me. But let me return to the spiritual practice that I started with, that song, a 3-minute practice for approaching my grief on purpose. It's real, it works, and it's more reliably moving than anything else I've ever tried. But I did not curate it alone. My sister made that playlist. She chose the songs. She sequenced them. And she did that while she was grieving too. And then she gave it to me. I did not sit down and design a grief practice. I received one from someone who knew our father and knew me, which means something that looks like a personal, private, self-made spiritual practice is in fact evidence of the opposite. Even my most solitary practice was communal, made by another person, given to me. And that's not a small distinction, because I think when we say we have self-curated our spirituality, it actually just means we've stopped crediting others. Every practice I've assembled for myself came from somebody, a tradition, a community, a teacher, a sister. And calling it mine mostly means I've stopped asking where it comes from or stopped remembering where it comes from. So I gently suggest that we're not as well placed to be our own curators as we think. And now I want to say something directly to those of you who've left religion, or who are leaving, or who are barely hanging on by a thread. Many of you were formed by institutions that stopped being resources for you. And some of you were formed by institutions that hurt you, and that's a real loss. But I don't think the answer is a personal spiritual blend necessarily. I've spent a book's worth of time at that spiritual salad bar we're all eating at, and I've come to think that the trouble isn't the picking and choosing, it's that we stop caring what's in each ingredient. And the ingredients we keep leaving behind are the four we just walked through. The rules, the authority that knows your name, the obligations, and other people generally. I'm not asking you to go back, but I'm asking you whether the thing you're missing was never really belief. Because what I want as someone without religious identity and no plans to get one is something engaged and challenging and disruptive, something that decenters me, something that tells me what to do in this particular moment. And it's a particularly hard moment we're living through right now, rather than just soothing me, something that asks for conviction and discipline and accountability to other people. I'm not interested in spirituality that's only about my own enlightenment anymore. But religion that is demanding and comes with obligations, I think that has potential. So some of what I've talked about today or tonight are chapters in Beyond Wellness, but there's much more in the book there that I didn't have time for. So there are copies, as mentioned, in the Festival Bookshop. If you want the long version that I couldn't finish in 35 minutes, that's where it lives. But thank you for listening, and I'm really excited to hear your questions.
Thank you, Liz. I think I'll start off by just reflecting on one thing, that a year ago on this stage, we had the musician Brian Eno, and he was talking about a choir that he helps to direct. And, you know, anybody who does music, you know, you're used to the idea that you perform, you have a concert. And this choir actually performed behind closed doors. They never performed to anyone else. They only did it as an act for themselves. And in doing so, subverted the idea of what a choir actually looks like. And instead of giving the music to other people, they were actually giving it to each other, which obviously changed the dynamic of it as an artistic endeavor. And that reminds me quite closely of what you were saying there, the idea of who do we give our faith to, but more importantly, where does our faith come from? And there were some amazing ideas there. And you know, as Liz said, Beyond Wellness is her book. It is available in the G bookstore. I would say that they probably close quite early. So once you're finished here, head over, grab it. But if not, of course, you can get it from a lovely independent bookseller and not somebody who'll deliver it your door within 3 hours of ordering it, one hopes. But have we got any questions for Liz after that amazing talk? And I have to say, Liz, there's so much to digest there. It is really rich. And I can see how you're saying, you know, there is a lot to unpack in 35 minutes. But do we have any questions from the floor?
So I think you've touched on this a little bit, but I wanted to ask, so for context, I'm an atheist by technical terms, but I do attend church. And there's a bit of me that feels I'm a bit uncomfortable about this, because I'm going into somebody else's sacred space where I have no sacred, you know, connotations to it. And I think, you know, you've talked about this a bit, that those of us who don't have that spiritual connection are trying to take the good parts of religion without taking all of it. And I wondered if you could comment on kind of the ethics of that. You know, are we just appropriating other people's sacred things for our own well-being or to try and improve our own lives, you know, live longer or whatever?
So thank you so much for that question. So one thing I should have said about myself is that I'm actually a religious ethicist. So for me, I'm always interested in the ethics of this. My last book was actually a book about religious appropriation. It was called Stealing My Religion. And then Beyond Wellness is sort of the my like, so now where do I go now if I think all this is appropriation and exploitative? Let me give you one example. I mean, I think those are the right questions to be asking. And I think it's why I find whatever this new form of spirituality or religious curiosity right now very different and interesting compared to, say, the 70s. Because I think if I think of my students, for example, they're very concerned about issues of exploitation and structural injustice and not extracting just from communities that they're not part of. But one way to think about, so one example I have in terms of like what how I had to grapple with this in the new book is just the example of psychedelics, right? Because everyone was like, oh, you should go do some peyote with an indigenous community, or you should go do an indigenous sort of plant-based ceremony. But the more you learn about those ceremonies, often those communities don't want to have non-Native people as part of them. And I respect that. And I think the lesson to be learned is not everything is for you. That's a hard lesson to hear as a white person, quite frankly, because I haven't been told that my whole life. But to be like, oh, I'm sure that an indigenous ceremony would be valuable for me to learn about, and maybe even valuable for me personally, but that community doesn't really want me there. And so I'm not going to try to enter that space. In contrast, the Santo Daime community that I did like go to really is part of like their, you know, it's part of what they do is they invite other people into this 3-day ceremony who are not part of the church. So I think that like if the space is inviting to you, you don't need to feel guilty for just guilty's sake, right? Like I think often religious communities are very welcoming to people who are questioning and seeking. But I think it's also important to think about that first question that you asked, right? Like, am I extracting something or am I learning it from someone or buying it from someone who's extracted it from a community that's maybe marginalized? I just think those are really important questions to just continue to ask yourself. And that just means that you're engaging this all ethically to keep that questioning going.
Thank you, Liz. What a brilliant start for our questions. Thank you so much.
I did listen to your talk. I must admit my eyes did close at some points. I am interested in this idea that you think that it's okay to appropriate ideas from different groups and that somehow there's a they've got something that you're interested in finding. What you didn't seem to take into account is relationship. And for myself, my Christianity is all about relationship. And for me, my relationship with my God in the name of Jesus is the central character and the central point. And it doesn't matter to me. You can come into my church, and I come from a very inclusive church, and we welcome everybody. And the idea for us is that everybody within the community can have their own relationship with an everlasting God, and that is the central tenet of Christianity, this personal relationship. And the Bible is full of stories of people that had a relationship with the gods from Adam and Eve through to Revelation and John. So, the question is, why, with all your research, did you not come across this concept of relationship and the importance of relationship within any community?
Yeah, so let me answer that question a couple of ways. One is that community is like central theme of the book. Like, I think partly what I'm trying to push back against is the individualization of sort of like the spiritual seeking in Salabar, or just the individualism of like modern culture, right? So for me, religious communities and traditions and people have become thought partners for me thinking through myself, like what an ethical life, what a flourishing life looks like. So like definitely everything is always in community. And that's part of what I think we left behind at sort of, like, for example, for my dad, he left that on the table. If he had been able to lean into the community and the fellowship of AA, he might have gotten something more from it. But I also want to say something that the way that you just described community and this personal relationship with God, it's a very Christian idea, but it's a very Protestant idea. It's like one way to think about religion. And part of what I love about being a comparativist, because I study all sorts of religious traditions, indigenous religious traditions, Asian religious traditions, Eastern religious traditions, is that that idea is not always the central core of the tradition. And that there are other ways of thinking about relation, which is not necessarily this personal relationship to a deity, for example, or theism. And so for me, it's not a question of like one being right or wrong, or me telling you what's right or wrong, but really understanding religious diversity as a way to help me figure out a thicker understanding of human relation, I guess, relationality. So let me give you an example of I love indigenous worldviews because for me, they are there's such a difference from sort of mainline white Protestantism, which is so dominant, certainly in my country and your country in terms of like the cultural understandings and philosophical understandings. You know, religious worldviews are not about that sort of individual sort of relation. It's all about ancestors and networks, and not just like people, but like plant life and rocks. And like, so there's this whole worldview that thinks about things as kin, like the mountains are kin, the trees are kin, in a much different way than we think about in terms like when we, I say like in a sort of mainline Protestant way, think about kinship and community. And that really changes the way I think about the world and my relationship and my responsibility to the world. So it's not that you're wrong that doesn't come up, but it's just like one way to think about community and relation, I guess.
Thank you. I wanted to pick up a bit on relationality and a bit on the individualism that I think is also really a sort of consumerization of our subjectivity, really, because of the marketized capitalist context we're in and how that has come into religion in this pick and choose way that can look like taking personal ownership or appropriation. And I heard in what you said something about being known and being mutually accountable that does feel very relational in a human way, maybe not in an explicitly religious way. And my question is, pushing against that exploitation of our desire for life to be easy, What is that kind of human instinct that might say, I need this thing that I don't really want to choose, but I know that I need it, you know, that like I need to find somewhere I can offer something to a community. And would you say or see that as something that is kind of counter-consumerist?
Yeah, so great question. I mean, just to like flesh out your idea, the consumption consumerist thing, a lot of what I think gets sold to me anyway, or offered to me as a spiritual practice that's available to me as a non-religiously affiliated person, is practices that are extracted and commodified and sort of made to look So the argument is sort of like, well, this thing is not religious anymore, so it's safer for you, and we'll put a price tag on it, and you can use it how it works for you. That is all wrapped up in consumption and capitalism. I think your question about friction is really interesting, because I think I'm like a mother of an 18-year-old. I teach college students, so I think a lot about this age too, and their desire to stay away from friction, right? And stay away from conflict, and to have these like frictionless lives that we're sort of creating for everybody. And that's, you know, that's also what AI does for us too, right? And the friction, the mess, that's part of the human flourishing. I mean, I think your question is, how do I lean into that? I think the truth is, life happens and you will lean into whether you want to or not. So I've been thinking about myself. So my book ends with a chapter on buying psychedelics, which I didn't really go, I went a little bit into, but it's actually a lot about me dealing with the trauma of my dad passing, because I was there the night he passed giving him the morphine, and I experienced that as a trauma because it wasn't a very peaceful death. And it meant that I came out of the book thinking a lot about, you know, I don't think enough about death, because I avoid thinking about death, right? But really understanding death is part of a good life. And we don't talk, particularly in the US anyway, we don't talk a lot about death at all. It's very medicalized, it's very closeted, people, no one wants to talk about it or have experience with it. But I actually think that like leaning into that will make my life now as a midlife woman better. So I'm doing hospice volunteer training. I'm gonna do death doula training, because I just think that that friction point for me, which is a hard thing for me, is actually beneficial to my own real well-being. How do you make yourself do something that you don't want to do? I think that's partly the role of the relationality, the community. I mean, the example of my trainer is just supposed to be like an easy example, but like it's the coach, it's the teacher. Like, I think we really don't like the idea, a lot of us don't like the idea of authority figures, but like an authority figure who's good is just a good teacher, right? It's a guide who's trying to help you to be the best version of you, not the version of them, right? So I think that someone who can see you and say, go over to the pull-up bar and try the pull-up, go over to the hard thing that you don't want to do, or the community that expects you to show up with a casserole on Saturday afternoon, even though you don't want to show up with a casserole, that is really building real community versus just a sense of belonging, which sometimes can be just a feeling, just a mood, or just extractive. So it's really, I think it's finding those people who will do that for you, finding your, you know, your coach, your clergy, your teacher, whoever, or if it's not a person, it's a community that can do it. But it's hard, but we're all looking for, right? I don't have an easy solution. It's probably not one size fits all either.
Hi. So I grew up in a fundamentalist Christian family in the UK, and I've gone through deconstruction, and now I would call myself somewhere between progressive Christian and atheist. And a question that I have is of sort of grand narratives. So for me, it was the Christian gospel, but also you could consider transcendence or enlightenment and other things like that. And I'm just wondering what you've observed in that area, because I think my question is that a universal human desire or need? It felt like when I was a teenager, there wasn't really many grand narratives around, and I was the weird Christian that had that grand narrative. And now it feels like the opposite. It feels like grand narratives are everywhere, especially in politics. And yeah, religion is kind of back in some ways. So yeah, is that a desire and need that I'm thinking? Is it something I need to get rid of and extract my, you know, my utopian visions out of myself, because that's all dangerous? Or is it a universal human need and desire?
Such a rich question. So I think that some people always, there's always prediction that religion's going to go away, right? And I don't think it ever will. It may be kind of morph, because I think we are storytelling creatures, and religious traditions are really good storytelling. So I don't think it's going away. But I want to answer your question with two things I've been thinking about. One is that, and there are actually two things I wrote about. I have a Substack called Religion Reimagined, two of the pieces I wrote about my Substack. One is about imagination and imagining a better future. And I actually have been thinking about the fact that I have trouble imagining right now with everything that's happening in the world, because there's a lot happening, right? There's political stuff happening, there's technological stuff happening, there's environmental stuff happening. I feel very unmoored and unsure of what's happening, what's coming in the future. And I think not having a religious tradition that I really feel grounded in means I have some trouble imagining the better future, right? And it's interesting, if you're talking about progressive versus, like, left versus right, I think the right is very good at imagining a future. They have, in the US, they have a playbook, they know where they're going. Versus the left is better, not as good at it. There's a way in which I think religious traditions can train your theological imagination, can train you to imagine something in the future, a different future, or even when you can't see it, even when it's not guaranteed to happen, but it allows you to act in the moment. And that's the other thing I wanted to say, another way to answer your question is that we all have an eschatology. We don't want to call an eschatology, but we all have in our heads somewhere some idea or some gut instinct about where we think the end game for humanity is, you know, human life or just life is. Like, what's the ultimate future that we think is coming? And religions are very good at this. And reasons why eschatologies are so important, having a vision of the end game, is because if you know what your eschatology is, you know what you should be doing today, or what you maybe shouldn't be doing today, because that's the only way to bring about that sort of future, right? And I think that eschatology may not be the word that's used, but I do see a clash of eschatologies going on in the world right now. I'm writing about this. I just had a piece in Time Magazine come out earlier this week, about this in terms of Silicon Valley and the AI tech bros who have an eschatology. They have a vision of the world, and it's that AI will take over and that humanity won't be important anymore. And that's why, in today's times, they're not investing their billions and millions into, I don't know, education or feeding children or social services or social justice, because for them, most of us are not going to like make it into this vision of the future. And so I think that those storytellings, and especially the ones we tell about the future, are so crucial to our politics today and ethics, whether or not they're theistic or religiously based. We're all doing it all the time, and it really, really, really affects what we do today.
I just wanted to say, Liz, that talk was really, really engaging, so thank you so much. It was really interesting to hear about the four kind of main refutes towards being religious. I'd love to hear what you found in your research that really drew people to religion, and whether there was anything that really surprised you.
So she asked a question that I can't answer briefly, though. So that's a big question. I'd be interested to hear if I've missed any of the big reasons why people don't like religion. I mean, I think people, if I think about my students and sort of like my, also my midlife sort of friends being really drawn to religion for community, but mostly for purpose, meaning making sort of qualities. I think that I've been a little surprised because a lot of the conversation after my book came out has been about people's political sort of imagination that I was just talking about, and how they're really looking to, some of the loudest progressive voices have been religious in the US particularly, against sort of what's happening maybe in our administration. And I think the progressive left, which tends to be secular in the US, was surprised by that. And so are increasingly looking to religious resources for what progressive politics can look like and what response can look like. Oh my God, there's so many things I was surprised by doing this book. I think I can think of one little nugget. I think partly what I've been surprised by is the reception of the book. I wrote this book and I was worried I was going to make all the yoga teachers mad. And yoga teachers loved reading this book. And I thought I was going to make a lot of clergy mad, but like clergy had been using my stuff in sermons. So I guess I'm pleasantly surprised at how I didn't start a conversation. I entered a conversation that was already happening. And again, the idea that like people who are deconstructing religion actually have so much in common with people who never had religion at all, have so much in common with people who are, you know, preaching from the pulpit right now too. And that these are conversations people have kind of been hungry to have and a container to have them in. So that's been really, really fun to see how very far this is like, or different sorts of people have interest in this conversation. I sort of say I like to set a table. All I'm doing is setting a table and inviting people to come, and I've been surprised how diverse the guests have been.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk, and sorry to hear about the loss of your father as well. I help lead a youth group in my church, and I grew up, Christianity was not cool. We sort of hid it, and if we were very brave, mentioned it. Now it's cool to be a Christian, but it's all about experience, not about truth. So because they don't trust truth, because there's AI, and how do you know what truth is? But you can trust authentic experience. So my question, I guess, is how do you... You've clearly researched and found some really authentic things for yourself, but how do you bring up kids? Is there a truth? And who do you give your... Who do you give authority to? Who do you give that permission? How do you choose... And if you're a child and not able to make that decision, do you know, what do I tell my kids? Is there a place or not?
Just a small question.
Yeah, a little small question. Okay. So the first, I mean, the second part of the question is sort of about like, how do you pick a teacher? How do you pick a guide, right? And so, I mean, I think there are red flags and there are green flags, right? So for me, I'm interested in somebody who's not trying to monetize me, who also isn't, like, a good teacher is trying to work themselves out of a job, right? Like, who is someone who's really trying, like, I know more than you now. This is how I teach my students in college. I know more than you know now at the beginning of the semester. But the idea is I'm going to give you this stuff, and at the end of the semester, then you're going to be able to do this kind of thinking too, right? So who's trying to work themselves out of a job? Who's able, I think good teachers too, or good guides, are also people who are willing to be criticized and pushed back on and welcome that sort of, you know, versus being high control. So I think it's really a question of like these red flags and green flags. But I want to, because it's just such a good question, I want to mention something about the authentic issue, because I think you're right. Young people they're like, I want the authentic thing, whatever that is. And I think that's a trap. And let me give you like one concrete example. I'll try to be brief. So I used to lead a study abroad on the Camino de Santiago. So I take my college students to a month to Spain, and we study comparative religion in the South, and then we walk the Camino for a couple weeks. And my students were like, wanted to do the Camino right. You know, they wanted to do the authentic, and they were upset that we had our bags transferred, or they're upset that we didn't go the whole 500 miles. It wasn't the whole thing. And or some days they were like, oh, we did this right because, you know, we did it the right way, the authentic way. And I was like, whoa, guys, that's a myth. This is a pilgrimage site that was miraculously discovered when the Christian church was trying to get the Moors out of northern Spain. Like, there's a history here, right? And then there's a history of pilgrimage that is politicized by the church and by Spain, by the nation. And then the tour guides we're talking to also have a political spin on it. Plus, I gave you guys a syllabus. I literally told you where to walk every day. I'm curating your entire experience. There is no perfect authentic, like, they are comparing, like, this is not like going to Disney World, this is so much more authentic and real. And I think that that is a little bit of a trap, because I think that it can lead to sort of self-righteousness and judgment of other people, but also there's no way to get to that thing, right? So I think it's a question of like finding the experience situated in a tradition or a community that feels like it has integrity, right? Not that it's like the perfect example, but that it's doing the work that you want it to do. It's remaking you the kind of person you want to be, that it aligns with your core values. And I actually think the work that young people should be doing more with is thinking about their core values. Like, what are your core values? They might not be the same as mine. What is important to you? And then you can find teachers that line up with those core values, experiences that reinforce them. But like, you know, who do you want to be? Like, and what's the world that you want to like live in? And I think articulating those core values and talking them through is probably more valuable than jumping into the experiences.
Liz, thank you very much. It's super interesting. You seem to have looked into a lot what kind of wellness culture can or should maybe learn from religion. What do you think, or do you think there is anything that kind of religious practices can learn from wellness culture? Are there things that is done better or differently that we could learn from?
That's an interesting question. I mean, in general, I'm sort of think the wellness industry has done more harm than good. I guess one thing that the wellness culture, one thing that my deep dive has allowed me to do is thinking about the wellness culture itself, sometimes the parts of it that are problematic or unethical or are, I think, undermine our well-being are because just like versions of maybe one type of theology got mainstreamed without the larger container. So something I'm thinking about, like diet culture, I have a whole chapter about food and diet culture and how valorizing thinness and moralizing food, some food is good, some food is better, or the importance of aestheticism and restriction, that those are like, that's some theological baggage in diet culture, right? And so I think that like there's ways in which other versions of religion really, I mean, that's kind of like where every chapter goes. It's like, what is the way that this religion can inform the wellness sort of practice of wellness understanding around food better? I don't know what I think the wellness culture is doing better than religions. I'm not like an apologist for religion. I think there's lots of problems with religion. I'm still a skeptic at my core. But I do think right now we've swung so far the other way that it's a nice corrective to like a fuller understanding of well-being that's not just the things that my wearable is tracking, right? So it doesn't matter that my muscle mass is greater, I can do a pull-up, that's not, as I move into this next phase of my life, or as I raise my daughter, or as I think about building relationships, or I help other family members transition or die, that my wearable is not going to help me with that. Or as I try to respond to what's going on politically. And I think the wellness culture has been so focused on just like us, like as if we could be healthy and well isolated from the world around us, that it's just it missed the boat. So, but I'll think more about that. That's a good question. Like, what has wellness culture gotten right?
What a brilliant place to end. And can I just say a really big thank you to you, Greenbelts, for your questions. But oh my goodness, Liz, thank you so much. Your book, Beyond Wellness, I think today you've taken us beyond so many different things and given us so many different things to think about. And yeah, okay, shameless plug for the book. I just wonder if that conversation is going to continue when we start reading those pages. But can we just give a big green belt thank you to Liz Voskar for what an amazing talk.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks for all the great questions, too.
A perfect example of academic work made readable, understandable, without losing any of its depth or complexity. So thank you so much, Liz. It's been wonderful having you here with us this evening.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.